This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. All right, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for another episode of the Western Rookie Podcast. Hopefully everybody's having a good week today. Today's guest, and I'm going to be completely honest with you, I don't know anything about you, other than this Colton guy we know says, hey, this girl, she knows a thing or two about elk hunting. And I'm like, well, let's talk to her and see what happens then. So Jess Byers, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. It's good to connect with you.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. First question, where do you live and what do you do for a living?
I currently live in Frenchtown, Montana, and I moved up here a couple of years ago to work for Montana Knife Company. So okay. I am their brand relations manager. I manage all of the like industry contacts, ambassadors, nonprofit relationships, hopefully keeping all of our partners happy and excited to work with us. So yeah, I've been here for a couple of years. I moved up here just for that job.
Oh, nice. Well, that's crazy. This Montana Knife Company, they're doing well. And the reason I say that is because when influencers or regular Joes are wearing the Montana Knife Company hats just around, then you know there's a little bit of motion behind that brand when the marketing seems to be working fairly well. So that's cool. How long have you worked for Montana Knife Company?
I started a couple of years ago. Actually, last week was my 2-year anniversary. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah, my previous role, I basically finished up at the Hunt Expo, and then the next week I moved to Montana. So,
oh, nice.
Been a fun journey. I always tell people I feel like I've been here quite a bit longer just because literally the day that Josh launched the company, I met him on a mountain shooting bows.
Oh, nice.
And he had just kicked his website live. And that was 5 years ago in 2020. And nobody knew anything about MKC. And I certainly didn't know who he was when I shook his hand, but I've always been a little bit obsessed with knives. I've kind of collected them since I was a kid and used them in the field after I met him. And I thought, man, what a quality product, but then the story behind it kind of makes you fall in love with the company. It's easy to buy into, in my opinion.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Where did you live before Montana?
Utah. Like,
where'd you grow up?
Well, I grew up in Texas, so I'm from the South. I grew up in Central Texas, just north of Austin, and never thought I'd leave. I still love to say if Texas had mountains, I'd have never left.
Yeah.
I just love it down there. And my whole family lives down there. But I fell in love with mountain hunting. Basically, the short story is that when I got married, my dad offered me an elk hunt for my wedding gift. I didn't know anything about elk. I didn't know what a bugle was. I'd never hunted outside of Texas. But it was a hunt with my dad. And I was like, I'll go anywhere with him. So we went and got my first bull. And it was that was kind of like the turning point of, I want to live in the mountains one day. So when the opportunity came up to move to Utah, Southern Utah, I worked for Hunt and Fool before Montana Knife. I was there for a little over 4 years. And I just thought, what a natural transition into learning how to draw tags across the states and get more time in the mountains and it not just be a wealthy man's game, the way that a lot of people say. Like, there is a way to draw and be successful and have tags in your pocket. And so really fell in love with that. I love Southern Utah, but Montana is I would describe Montana as like a Texas in the mountains, honestly. Yeah. The people, the culture, just has this really cool energy about it. And it also opened up a lot more hunting opportunities as a resident that I never had when I lived in Utah. It was seemed impossible to hunt anything there other than like spikes and cows, which Don't get me wrong. That was a blast. But yeah, it's been fun. It's been a really fun journey. It's been a long journey, but I knew I wanted to live in the mountains one day. And it was that first elk hunt that really, like, it got in my blood, I would say. Kind of woke something up in me.
Well, I'll be completely honest with you. That the fact your dad gave you an elk hunt for your wedding present is pretty sweet. I think we got pillows for wedding presents. You know how boring that is? Like, who's that for? Right? Does your husband hunt?
Oh yeah.
Did he come on the elk hunt?
He got offered. My dad offered to buy both of us a tag. But at the time he had a job that was just, he was in construction and he could not get away. Yeah. And so the running joke is like, oh yeah, you took my wife on an incredible elk hunt. She killed her, you know, biggest bull. And I got to stay back and scoop cat crap for y'all as a pet sitter. I'm just like, I'm so sorry. In the moment, I didn't think anything of it. I was like, oh, whatever. I get to go home with my dad. But yeah, so we went on a honeymoon ourselves, but that was his gift to me. And honestly, my dad's been wanting to hunt elk. He had been wanting to hunt elk for a long time.
Yeah.
That was just his like excuse to do it. And now it's become an annual thing. We meet every year in New Mexico and hunt archery elk together. So it's pretty cool.
That's awesome. That's an awesome tradition to have. Okay. So your first elk hunting experience was when your dad bought you that elk hunt.
Yeah.
And what state was that in?
New Mexico.
Okay. New Mexico. So talk to me a little bit about, actually, before we get into the rest of today's episode, I do have to send a quick thank you to the brands that support the Western Rookie podcast. So if you are looking for your next year's archery season, next year's elk hunt, mule deer hunt, if you're a bow hunter, go check out wasparchery.com. These guys have a complete lineup of fixed and mechanical broadheads. I've been using the 3-blade jackhammer for probably 15-ish years now. So go check out wasparchery.com. Most of their heads are still manufactured in the United States, which I don't know about everybody else, but for me, that's kind of a big deal. Wasparchery.com. I do have a discount code NFC20 for 20% off. Next on the list is Montana Decoys. There's a lot of people out there who use decoys to get inside the quote unquote, my buddy CJ from Montana Decoy says the kill bubble. He tries to get in the kill bubble with some decoys, whether that's antelope, mule deer, whitetail, elk, you name it, they have it. Turkey season's coming up. They have turkey decoys as well. So go check out montanadecoy.com. All right, there. That's how I make my money. Just horn out just a little bit, tell everybody a little bit about some products, and then get back into the story here. Talk to me a little bit about that first elk hunt and what that was like, having never done it before.
It was a wake-up call. Like my background being just whitetail hunting, turkey hunting, pig hunting, coyotes, all the things you can hunt in Texas from a tree stand, ground blind, flat land, no altitude, like very different conditions. And certainly more than a few hundred yards from your house. Right. Like, so I was exposed to, it was very intimidating, quite honestly. Like, thankfully it was guided. So I had some guidance there, like as far, like I wouldn't have known what to do, honestly. Yeah. You put me on in the mountains at that time in my life, and the thought of getting lost was just terrifying to me because I always knew where I was on any property I was hunting in Texas. It's like, it's pretty streamlined. Well, I remember that being really intimidating, but it was the rush of hearing a bugle at shooting distance that like, made my whole body go numb. Like I thought that was the coolest thing I'd ever experienced in my life. And unfortunately it was an early season hunt that year. You know, when you get a landowner tag, you choose what season that you're going to hunt. I ended up hunting the first season, the earlier season. They weren't talking very much. I did get to hear them a little bit, but ended up hunting over water quite a bit because also at that time in my life, with the background that I had killed plenty of things with my bow, but it was in Texas at 30 yards and under, you know? Yeah. So you start pushing out west. Is it impossible? No, but ideally you be comfortable at 50 or 60 or, you know, whatever that is for you. I'm not trying to put pressure on anybody, but I remember that year going up and my guide said, well, what are you comfortable at? And I'm like, dude, I'm not shooting past 40. I had a 20, 30, 40 fixed pins. Didn't even know what a slider was at the time. Like, again, it's not necessary where I hunted before. And I could just see the look of defeat. Like, oh man, okay, we're gonna put you on some water because they're quiet anyway. And it was a 5-day hunt. Ended up extending it 2 more days. And on the last night, the very last night of those extended days, I ended up getting one, but it was, they put me on a tank or pond, water, whatever, for the entire day. I sat 15 hours by myself with no one there and never saw an elk until last light. And it was a herd bull that came in with all his cows. And thank God he came in on the side that he did, because it gave me a 20 yard shot broadside as he was walking out of the water. And he never knew what hit him. I had a complete pass through. That was the other thing I was really intimidated by, because, you know, I shot 43 pounds, 45 pounds for a long time. For this hunt, I worked up to 50 pounds. Even that is still on the lower end, I would say, of like at minimum what you want to shoot when you're hunting elk. And so yeah. I had this, you know, just had some doubts, like, can I shoot as far as I need to? Is it going to go through? Blah, blah, blah. So anyway, the adrenaline started to work against me. I remember I almost didn't get my bow pulled back because I just had, he was bugling at 20 yards over water at sunset. It was like a dream. And when he flipped back around to walk back out up the bank, I was already at full draw. And I was like, as soon as I can see his belly to kind of gauge where I'm going to hit, I'm going to let one fly. And I did. And I got a straight pass through. He didn't know what hit him. He was just kind of jumped, and then he just kept cruising up and he stood there. And I remember back at camp, one of the things they said about elk is, if you can keep putting arrows in them, please do, because nobody's there to watch where your arrow is. And right. So I knocked one, I army crawled out of the, it was just kind of like a brush blind that they built for me the day before. I army crawled out of there and stood up, and he gave me another 20-yard broadside shot, and I heard him crash like 100 yards away. And I just remember my whole body like, what the hell just happened? Like, what, you know, just a very pivotal moment in my journey as a hunter, from just like the little kid that ran around on ranches and knew all about whitetail management and, you know, predator hunting and things like that. But nothing of this world. It just opened up a whole new world for me. And I remember texting my dad, bull down. Like, I heard him crash. I'm not over him, but I heard him crash. I heard him take his last breath, like he's done. And the excitement and just the feeling, I could just tell how proud he was. And like, as my, you know, youngest daughter, and I say the favorite, I get to tell him super proud. And I know that is, this will always be a special time in my life for multiple reasons. There's a lot of layers for that, but
yeah,
exposing me to the mountains, exposing me to elk hunting, giving me that gift with my dad, and then starting this kind of like a reunion with him every year. This thing that
yeah, I like the story, and I'll be honest with you. I like the way you told it, and the order in which you said things. And then at the end, I think a lot of times, especially when we start to tell hunting stories, if we don't tell, if we don't tell things in a certain order, like what you did a great job of laying it out there, then people start to be like, oh, she was with an outfitter, or oh, must be nice to own 1,000 acres in Iowa, or, you know what I mean? Like those types of things. But that doesn't really matter in this case, because of, you know, I can tell by the way you were telling it, it means something to you. And at the end of the day, really, that's what I think the hunting community needs to get back to, is celebrating those types of stories. Back in the day when I had to come up with the first description for the very first podcast I ever started, One of the lines in the description was, it's not necessarily about the size of the animal, but about the experience itself and who you are sharing that experience with is at the end of the day, the most important thing. And so, listening to you tell that story made me jacked up because like, I hope someday that I'm able to share, a story like that with my daughter or my son, in a crazy new environment like that.
Well, I certainly know what you're talking about. To say that I never got any backlash for it would be.
Oh, yeah, no one gives a shit. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, but yeah. I thankfully grew up and was exposed to hunting well before that, where you pull up to a gas station with a buck in your truck and everybody's excited. Doesn't matter what it is.
Right.
Like high-fiving and celebrating. And I know what it's like to, you know, have that support. And there's some really, you know, good people in the space.
Absolutely. So, absolutely. Yeah. So you kill that deer or that buck, or geez, I'm still in whitetail world. You kill that bull. What was it like walking up to it for the first time? Did you have to wait for someone to come and get you, or did you go follow blood by yourself?
No, they made me wait, which I get. Like, you have this chick who doesn't know anything about elk hunting, literally said she's never heard a bugle, you know, all the, like, I get it.
Yeah.
But I know what a crash sounds like. So I was like, God, you're telling me I can't go look at him. And I had to, we went back to the lodge. We ate dinner with all the other hunters that were there. And, which that was cool. Cause when, you know, when I walked in, everybody was cheering and high fiving, even though I hadn't put my hands on him yet. And I waited for, I mean, it was at least an hour. I want to say closer to two. They just wanted to be really freaking sure.
Yeah.
I remember them questioning me, like, are you sure you hit him? I'm like, I'm sure I have two pass-throughs. One of my arrows floating in the water. Like, I promise you. And yeah. It was cool. So we had to wait, which it was so cool because I got to go back with my dad and like recover him with him. So yeah. he was really stoked.
What was it like for you touching an elk for the first time? I always say it's awesome. And it's part of one of the reasons I like shed hunting for antlers so much, or I used to when I had more time, or even like touching the deer that I kill and picking the head up or picking up an antler. I'm the first human being to ever touch this animal. You know what I mean? That's a pretty exciting moment. What was that like for you?
Well, I had to get help even like tilting them up because they're so like I didn't really fully grasp. You know, you kind of, I don't want to say I blacked out because I do remember every moment, but like I couldn't really grasp how big that he was standing there. And honestly, I remembered the smell more than the touching him. You walk up and smell elk for the first time, you're like, what in the world is that?
Yeah.
But yeah, coming from the whitetail world, I mean, I had never touched antler that big. So
yeah.
I think I was just overwhelmed. I was just truly overwhelmed. And I really didn't understand the quality of the bull that I had shot. You know, at the lodge, when I asked them, okay, I'm sitting by myself, what do I need to look for? You know, and you can't tell someone who's new, like, it's hard to get into, like, oh, look for, you know, like what sometimes people say, oh, if they have really solid threes, it's probably a good bull. If he has really big broils, or if he had, they're like, you know, if he just has six on either side, shoot him. I'm like, well, now fast forward 10 years, I'm like, well, that can mean a lot of things. That could be a freaking. Yeah. little thing, but no, I ended up being a really solid, mature herd bull with a bunch of cows, and I think I appreciate that more from a management standpoint of like my whitetail background, just because I was raised with such strict management guidelines. My dad, even till this day, we never hunt trophies; we hunt cull bucks. You know, I got to witness what it was like. Being on a 4,700 acre property that he rented, he leased for 10 years with the intention of growing big whitetail. And there wasn't a stand. There weren't any feeders. There weren't, like, he had to put fencing. He had to put a lodge. And we went from having these tiny, tiny little basket racks to, by the 10th year, he had a 190s class book. So you take that in, while it's a lot easier said than done in the mountains, because, like, don't get me wrong, I've shot smaller bulls too. But I was so proud when they told me that's a mature, older bull. Like, that is a hell of a bull. And it's still my biggest bull. Like, I've never shot anything bigger than that. So that meant a lot to me to get to carry over that management mindset, even though I don't judge anybody for not doing that. And I'm certainly not saying that I do that all the time every year. But
yeah. What, so you found success. When did you know, like, was this a one-off thing? Like, this is just my first and maybe my only elk hunt? Or how did you know? How did it turn into the tradition that it is today?
I mean, I think we just both were just ate up with it. The experience together, he really wanted redemption to get his, you know, to get an archery bull under his belt. I wanted to feel that high again. And it was just like, let's just do it. Let's just see if we can do it again. And let's just see if we, I mean, we took it a year at a time. And thankfully, over the last 10 years, we've built relationships with landowners who have unit-wide tags. So I'm all the bulls in New Mexico that I've ever shot are all on public land. But because they have the unit-wide landowner tags, it allows us to hunt public land. And you develop those relationships with the ranch owners who they like working with you. I mean, it's at the end of the day, you're working with people. And thankfully, he's developed great relationships that allow us to have that tradition. And I think it was just kind of like a, how can we not keep doing this as long as we can afford to, from financially and time. And, you know, as long as we can justify some of those things, we'd be so crazy not to do it. And it's been a really, I mean, beautiful journey, honestly. Like, I went several years without getting another bull. I mean, I think I went four years, because then we stopped going on outfitted. We just started buying the tags outright from the landowners that gave us access to the land to hunt publicly on our own. Well, now you're trying to figure it on your own. You're not there scouting all season. You're not guiding clients. You don't really have your feet under you. But so we had to figure it out. And that's been the coolest part. It's like, man, Dad, look how far we've come. We didn't know anything before, and now we can go set up our own camp and go out on our own, and we don't have to hire that extra help, which just shows, like, the growth of getting to know the animals and the land and find confidence behind your weapon. It took him 7 years before he got his first bull, and that's probably my second favorite memory in the field, was watching him draw back on what would be his first archery bull. Because usually when we hunt, we both have tags, so we go our separate ways. We hunt alone until one of us kills. We help each other pack out whoever kills first, and then we hunt together. That's like our tradition, because it's only a 10-day season for that hunt. And I had killed that year that I'd already tagged out that year that he got his. So I got to hunt with him, and he was feeling really down. He had pulled his hamstring and he was struggling to get around. My dad's, he's fixing to be 70 next month. So, just body starts working against you a little bit, and he was going to go home, and I just started crying. I'm like, Dad, you can't give up. Let's go just sit water. And he's like, I don't want to shoot a bull over water. I'm like, well, I don't want you to either, but it's better than going home. And I got him, I convinced him. And so then he got his bull sitting over water, and the adrenaline actually did work against him. I had to help him draw his bow back because he was trembling so bad, but he smoked that bull. And she's like, you can't just make those stories up in the field. Yeah. You know, it's like, so, it's just so special. And I wish everybody knew how special it was, not just elk hunting, not just bow hunting, but like getting to do it with someone that gave you that gift.
It's pretty
special. You know, he was really patient with me growing up and never pushed me to get behind a weapon. He was just always exposing me, always putting me around it. And then here we are. He's a lot of the reason why I'm where I'm at today.
That's awesome. So what was that like? What was that first season like after
You know, like the first year, bought a hunt, had some guides help you, put you in the right spot. What was that next season like where you guys were out on your own with no help, having to try to do it by yourself?
So I think it was for 3 years we hired outfitters and then we went the last seven or whatever. So I have to like run it back. But Well, first you notice like, because we really want to do the whole wall tent, you know.
Yep.
I didn't want to be in a lodge. So it's like, okay, now we need to got to think about everything. Who's going to be cooking? Who's going to, where, how big of a tent do we need to get? Like, we didn't know anything. Like, I mean, it was very foreign, but there's a sense of freedom about it. Like, you know, we'll just figure it out. Like, there's, it's okay. We'll figure it out. And it's been cool because even over the years, my, like my sister and her husband have started coming. Some of my nieces and nephews have come in, have started to come. And like, it has become a bigger family tradition. Maybe someone there's, and there's just also this respect of like, hey, whoever gets back first, we already know what's for dinner. Or if there's a group coming in from the morning, cook breakfast for them. Like, it's a very cool team, like splitting up all the, you know, the extra work that goes into it when you don't have someone doing it all for you. And it's been really special, but yeah, intimidating. I still tell everybody that my biggest insecurity is as a hunter, is navigation. Like without Onyx, I don't know. I mean, I'm not completely broken, but it's very intimidating. In fact, I'm going to take a land navigation course in a couple months and just kind of lean into it, lean into those, some of those weaknesses that I have, but it can still be a little bit that way depending on where, what state I'm hunting in. And I think a lot of people have that fear, honestly.
Oh yeah. I've been lost, not in the West, but I've been lost on a really cloudy overcast day where there wasn't a ton of shadows in a giant national forest in Alabama. I was lost for 8 hours and that started to freak me out when it started getting darker. But on this particular podcast, my buddy Joseph, he had a scare in Colorado, maybe? I forget. But he killed an elk and he had an elk pat a quarter on his back and he got lost because his Onyx wasn't working in the mountains. The GPS in all the cover and all the timber wasn't working and he got lost for multiple hours and he was screaming and finally he got lucky and ran into an area where the navigation was working on it. But dude, that's something that would freak me out, especially in like really big timber where you can't see anything for at long distance. So
yeah, totally. It can be very intimidating. And I always have an SOS, like I always have my Garmin InReach with me if I just happen to get in a really ugly situation. Even with the satellite texting now and how far all the technology has come, I don't risk it. Mostly when I'm by myself. If I'm with somebody, I'm a little less I don't want to say psychotic. It's not psychotic to have safety, but like I don't worry as much if I'm not alone. But when I'm alone, I don't take any risks. It's like I'm going to have a plan A, B, and C for sure.
Yeah. How big is this elk group every year now that you go to New Mexico with? Just you and your dad, or does your husband finally get to come now or what?
Yeah, so my husband has actually guided in New Mexico for every year for, I don't know, five or so. Once we started elk hunting and got ate up with it, he eventually got to come. I think it was 2 or 3 years later. He fell in love with it. Well, then he started guiding there because he'd always guided in Texas. And so he actually knows New Mexico very, very well. He spent, 3 months every year at a time guiding clients. And so up until this year, he's always been guiding at the same time. And would jump over if they killed out early or anything like that. This will be the first season where he's not guiding and he'll get to be with us more regularly, which is pretty cool.
Nice.
And then, sister and her husband, I would say at the most like 8 or 9 people, but it's flexing because it's, they can't stay the whole 10-day season, yeah. right? So we'll have yeah. a few people come here, a few people, and just kind of help out with pack outs and cooking and spending time.
So not everybody has a tag. Not every year. No. Okay, gotcha.
No, it's hard enough to find a few, honestly. Yeah. Like, they're a high demand thing. So,
right.
And that's been also my thing for my dad is like, hey, your tag comes first. Even if I don't get one, I'll still meet you down there. Like, I'm still going to come, even if I don't get yeah. to hunt, just to help you and be with family.
Yeah.
Thankfully that hasn't happened yet, but you know, the demand continues to rise, as you know. So
yeah,
hopefully I'll always have a tag, but if not, like I said, I've been building points in other states, lots of other states, and I have a lot of points I need to burn all yeah. over the place.
Yeah. So. Yeah. What's something that you've learned about elk in this 10-year period of chasing them?
The hardest thing for me to overcome was that they're not a whitetail. So you don't have to sneak around and be like, you can move differently with elk. I think also learning, you know, if they're raking a tree or they're fighting, like you can run full sprint at them a lot of times in those situations. And I've done it almost every season. I've done something like that. So learning when to move fast and when to slow down. Whereas with whitetail, I feel like it's just slow all the time. Like yeah. You have to be extra particular about every move, you know, when they're right under your stand. And I feel like if I just barely move, they're onto me. So
right.
That was something that really changed my success in the field. Like, don't be afraid to move quickly. If he's pushing the cows away from you, freaking sprint and stay with them. If you stay in them long enough, you will get a shot, but you have to stay up. You have to stay with them.
Yeah.
And if you even hesitate, you're probably not going to catch up to them. You know, right. It's like, so following that intuition. And again, you don't learn those things unless you're just in them long enough or you're with people that can mentor you. But I feel like I'm in elk a lot more frequently, trusting my gut of when it's okay to move fast. And then you're in the middle of a frenzy, the wind doesn't freaking matter. They're seeing, their eyes are rolled back. They're drooling. They're in their own world. And they're not getting your scent and taking off. They smell something else that they want. If you get yeah. a hot cow, you're in a really good situation. So little just nuggets you pick up with enough time in the field.
Did the time of year change? Because you said it was an early season hunt the first couple years. Did you change that timing to be more in the rut eventually? Mm-hmm. Or has it always been the same time of year?
So New Mexico has a 10-day season that's like on the front of basically the first half of September. And then they have the second season that's the 15th through the 24th. Now, I will always activate a tag for that second part of the second season. You'll hear some bugles in the first season. Well, it depends on where you are, right? But where I hunt, we always hear them in first season too, like mm-hmm. when we're scouting before the second season hunt. But they get cranked up in that second season, and that's when I want them. So a lot of people will argue too that if you want a bigger bull, hunt the first season before they're pressured. That's fine. You know, you're going to have better luck over water. I just like to be in them. I like to hear them and smell them and watch them do what they do. So
yeah,
I'll always activate my tag for that second season in hopes of getting more in the rut.
Gotcha. And that allows you to be more flexible, or I don't want to say make more mistakes, but be more aggressive with your approach to getting one within shooting range.
Yes, but it's funny. It's like at times I am aggressive, but in general, I would say I'm probably, so I don't call hardly at all. I might do a location bugle in the early in the morning if they're not talking, but like every bull that I've killed has been because they didn't know I was there. So I take the safer, quieter, let me just stay on their tails until they screw up versus being the one that's trying to call them in. both methods are great, depending on the situation, but I wouldn't call myself an aggressive hunter. I'm trying to get more aggressive in certain times, and it's worked. But in general, I guess I go back to that, like, I want them to do what they do without being alert of me in the area or questioning if I'm a cow or not, or if I'm a bull or not. So that's been really, really cool, because it's allowed me to sneak in. And like, I mean, my longest stalk took me an hour and a half to close the gap before I got an arrow in them. And it was, I loved every minute. It's just the way I prefer to do it.
Yeah. So what allows you to do that? Like, if you're not calling at them and they're not responding and you're trying to shoot them without them knowing you're there, are they actively talking so then you can locate them, or are you high glassing? How are you locating them first to get close enough to shoot them?
Typically I'm following a bugle, even if it's like they're only, he's only letting out a bugle every freaking 20, 30 minutes. Like, it doesn't have to be cranked up. Right. But being patient to know, like, I know there's a bull right there, and just waiting for him again, waiting for them to mess up. That's the ideal situation. Yeah. If they're not talking, I just get up on a high glassing point and just glass and glass until I find something worth chasing, and try to predict, you know, are they going in that dark timber to bed down? What, depending on like the temperature, and can I make a play? Can I try to move in midday when they are in their bed? Like, I've tried all those things, but everybody loves a consistent bugle to move in on. So most of the times that I've gotten close enough, it's because they are talking just enough, even if they're not cranked up, that I can make a play. And I have enough time to play the wind and be patient and not rush it.
Yeah. How often are you by yourself?
Quite a bit. Like, I would say, so on that tag every year, I would say at least half the season. So if it's a 10-day season, I'll hunt 5 days alone. I really love being by myself. It makes me forces me to think, I don't know, I guess just be more present with it. Like, I feel like my head's more on a swivel. I'm more attentive to like what I smell or what I hear. Like, my senses are on fire, whereas I have someone with me. I don't know, it's a little distracting, but I mean, I love hunting with people. In fact, I would say I like hunting with my family more than I like hunting alone. But as far as challenging myself as a hunter and seeing what, like, exposing my strengths and weaknesses, that's the best way to do that is hunting by yourself. 100%. And that's why I've always loved bow hunting, because you find out pretty quick what you need to work on.
Yeah. Did it take time to be comfortable hunting elk by yourself? Because, and I'll give you a little story. My first time ever elk hunting, I was with a group. I was with another guy, and I would basically just follow him because he had the most experience. The second time I went elk hunting, I was with a group of like three guys, and we were together. And then I found myself, like, there was one day where I slept in because I was just exhausted, because we were at like Colorado, 10,000 feet. And I slept in, and then I woke up on my own terms and then went up into the mountain. And I didn't go far enough, because I wasn't with a group of people. Like, we were encouraging each other, working together. Come on, let's go up another 500 feet, you know, or whatever the case is. And I found myself not putting in the max effort that I did when I was with a group of people. And so I don't know why I thought about that, but I'm just curious if it took you some time to be comfortable hunting with yourself on a species that was newish to you.
Oh, for sure. I mean, with the navigation aspect alone being so intimidating, that was the hardest thing to overcome. But I think it's been a little bit of a snowball effect, because thankfully, again, very different types of hunting, but as a young girl, having that childhood where my dad started to, like, you know, we started hunting together and I got a few things under my belt. And then he's like, he trusted me to take the gun out by myself and go get in the stand. And then he trusted me to start driving out, take his Jeep out, go get in the stand. Then it was, okay, I'm going to trust you to load the animal and clean it by yourself. And so I look at my journey as a hunter in these, like, these layers of having a parent that really poured into that independence in the field, that while, yes, it was flatland Texas, I could carry that confidence into the field and know that I was capable of finishing the job in the mountain. It also helps that I've, thankfully, I don't, like, darkness doesn't scare me. Predators don't scare me. I kind of live my life of, like, dude, if I'm supposed to die that way, I'm supposed to die. And it's really helped me a lot. I know it probably sounds pretty ignorant, but it's helped me be really free in the mountains and trust my gut and just enjoy it. Yeah. My husband, you know, if any time he gets frustrated with me when we are hunting together, it's like, she literally stops and smells the flowers. Like, she'll take pictures of flowers. If we hear a bugling bull far off, I'm like, yeah, I look at the whole experience as so special, and I soak up every little thing. And so I don't really get distracted by the fears of, what if this happens, or what if I don't make it back? And
there was always this stigma when I started doing what I'm doing. And even back in the day, that the woman was always the sidekick of another hunter, right? It was the wife or it was the daughter. And I personally hated that, like, which meant that my daughter doesn't get any shortcuts. I'm treating her equally. Like, I want, and it sounds like that's kind of what your dad did to you, right? He didn't coddle you. He didn't, was like, here, let me help you do this. Let me gut the animal. Let me do this. He's like, you go do it. Like, cause that's what I'm afraid. I don't want my daughter to be like the type of hunter who needs somebody to do everything for her. She's going to learn to do that for herself.
Yeah. I would say he helped me for until he could see that I chose to be more interested. Hey dad, right. I want to shoot a deer. Hey dad, I want to learn how to clean this. I want to learn. He waited for me to show interest rather than forcing it on me.
Amen.
Which is probably the most important thing for kids and women, just because we don't naturally, I don't think it's something that we naturally pick up the way that men do.
Right.
And little boys that want to go out with their little BB gun and shoot everything. Like, in most cases, we're not built that way. But if you can just expose them long enough and plant that seed, I think that they will always come back around. And if you're patient rather than forcing it, it's just another, it's a really easy way to turn a woman off from it too. And I don't know. I always tell people, keep them fed, keep them warm, and she'll stick around a lot longer. But a lot of these guys that I've hunted with were like, they'll take one bagged meal for an entire day. I'm like, no, dude, I load up on snacks and meals, and like, I'm going to eat good in the mountains, even if it's more weight on my back.
Gotcha. All right. So as this elk hunting journey is unfolding, for me, and I'm going to reference my whitetail journey. I sucked at it. When I made the decision to go after mature whitetails, there was probably a 10-year period where I didn't strike out every year, but when I was trying to accomplish a specific goal of being successful, whatever that goal is, I struck out a lot of years in that 10-year period till it started to click for me. When, or maybe it hasn't yet, you tell me, did elk hunting be kind of click for you, where it became less of like looking at a piece of paper and going through the steps to more of a free flowing experience in the woods where you knew what you were doing?
2021. It was my first solo bull. So up until that point, so the year before I had killed a bull. So 2015, I get my first bull. Then I went 4 would that be four more seasons? And 2020 was the first time I had killed another bull since my wedding gift. And I was with my husband, and he really was still there helping me, like, get here, get here. He's, mm-hmm. we're in the middle of a rut, just rut fest. And he was really good, again, as that guide telling me where I needed to be. But it was the following year that I had made a point. I was like, okay, I want to know that I can do this on my own. And so that year, I think I let my brother-in-law hunt with me one day or something. Like, I didn't let anybody hunt with me. I said, I'm going to do this on my own. And accomplishing that through and through, like, I chose the spot. I'd never been in that area in that unit. I chose a brand new spot, went down a road I'd never been down. And I just followed my gut. And that was a turning point of, like, just proving to myself that I could do it. Now, whether or not I wanted to be alone moving forward is a different story. But I wanted to prove myself that I can make the right decisions and get the job done. And so that was my 2021 bull. And I was just kind of on a, when you get that confidence, there's a momentum is a, yeah. hell of a drug, I would say. And so I just every year I was punching tags, and I'm currently in a lull, if we want to be real transparent. I've struggled last two seasons. I have had really pretty heartbreaking bull stories, so had shots at bulls, just didn't punch my tag. But yeah, I have full confidence in my ability for archery elk hunting now. But that was, you know, was that six or seven seasons before I hit that? Like, it takes a minute for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So in the last 10 years, how many elk have you killed with your bow?
Six.
Okay. So you take that and you match it up against the average of archery elk hunting success statistics, and you're doing really well. You know what I mean? Like, there, I think, like, for bow hunters, if you want to take it across all states, the success rate to fill an archery tag is probably close to 7%, right in there.
Yeah.
And so that's like, what, that's one bull every 10 years. That's crazy, give or take. Right. And so, you're doing well. That's gotta be a good feeling.
You. I appreciate it. I've also missed quite a few. Like, I, for anybody listening, like, if you hunt long enough, you already know that, but I would like to be super transparent and piece of humble pie now and then, like, I've definitely ate it. It's just, man, it's funny. It's a funny thing how I've had a spike in front of me in Utah, missed a spike at 30 when there's just like, I didn't even realize it could make me shake like it did. And then I've had, you know, my most proud bull in front of me and had all the confidence in the world. So it's funny how each moment behind your weapon, when you start getting in closer and closer, you really can't guarantee how you're going to feel. Like, it's such an up and down experience, and I freaking love it. But
yeah,
I just told Josh, our CEO, a couple of days ago, we're starting to hang heads all around. We just got in this new building a few weeks ago, and we're starting to get some stuff on the walls. And my husband and I have had a pile of taxidermy in a shed with nowhere to put it for years. So we brought it all up here, and we're hanging them. And we have a couple of my bulls out in the retail space. And I'm like, man, I cannot wait to feel that success again, just because I've gone two seasons without, you know, eating tag soup. So I'm going to hit it hard this year. And hopefully next time we talk after season, I'll be able to tell you a success story.
There you go. How many states do you hunt now? Is it just still only New Mexico, or are you living in Montana? Or are you trying to kill in Montana as well?
I am in Montana as well, but last year I gun hunted. I actually missed a stud with my gun last year. I'm hunting. I've hunted elk in Utah quite a bit. I've killed a bull in Idaho. One of my favorite trips, probably the thing that taught me the most about elk hunting wasn't in New Mexico. It was a Colorado trip. I packed in the wilderness for 21 days on horseback with my buddy, who's a firefighter. He's like my brother. And we had committed to 28 days, but 21 days, my husband's like, "Hey, haven't heard your voice in 21 days on the satellite phone." I'm like, "All right, I'm coming out." Yeah. But I didn't get one, but I learned more about elk hunting in that, just being packed in 12 miles in the wilderness and just basically like, go figure it out, you know? Yeah. So what would that be? Four or five states: Idaho, Montana, Utah, New Mexico, Colorado. Yeah.
What's the hardest state to hunt elk in out of your experience so far?
Probably Colorado, just with pressure. And that was at the time, this was a long time ago, but that was a 0 point unit. It's just like, I wasn't in a high density area that was really giving me a lot of opportunities. So that hunt kicked my butt. Like,
yeah,
really kicked my butt. But just the amount of pressure in Colorado, I think, alone. New Mexico, there's a lot of pressure, but I've noticed a lot of people don't like to hike. So as long as you can out hike them, you're good.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Montana, I'm still figuring out. It's too new. So, yeah. But there's vast opportunity and so much public land and so much, you have multiple tags in your pockets. And like, I'm really excited about this year to really pour into it. I've laid low the last couple years, just between my job. And honestly, I wanted to wait and burn my points with my husband. So now we're getting to do that this year. So I haven't been super aggressive in our state, but we'll see. I'm pretty excited.
Well, the good news is that you can start planning right now. It is, what do they call that? Application season. A lot of states have already kind of wound down, but application season for a lot of places is happening right now. So make sure that you go to wherever you need to go to research and find how to burn those points or how to get into your lotteries, Hunt and Fool and Go Hunt, and all those places have all that information. So go check that out. But Jess, I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to kind of hop on and share your elk hunting journey with us. And hopefully your drought is over in September this upcoming year and you put an arrow through a big fat elk.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. I appreciate the positivity, and it's good to connect with you.
If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.